speaking with Dr. Herbert Scoville on November the 21st in the afternoon in his home. Dr. Scoville is known nationally and probably internationally, but we here in Salisbury refer to Dr. Scoville as Pete. Many people know Pete and love him very dearly, and we'd love to get some of Pete's recollections about his family and himself. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Pete, to begin with. Whatever you know of your family, just proceed.
Yeah. I was telling you, Paul, I know very little about the Urim, the Hawk family, and what happened when they came here. They've been here a long, long time. They're in the iron and steel business. Particularly, I know that they were involved in manufacture of railroad wheels for railroad trains. It was one of the ironworks.
This was in Buffalo.
This was in Buffalo, where my father was born. And of course, but I think even before that, they had had some connection with the iron mines up here on the mountain, or halfway up the mountain.
Yeah, the mountain road.
Yeah, that's right. Your father used to work in those iron mines.
Yes, indeed he did, Pete. He worked on the top of the mountain in the charcoal days.
Yeah.
But there's an old mine, which we call the Scoville ore bed, which is still in back of Jack Fisher's house.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's interesting, because that piece of land up there was sort of lost for a long time. And Jack Fisher sort of resurrected it.
Yes.
Very nice.
Yes, and built a home there.
So now we have a little piece of that land ourselves.
Well, now we have your family coming to the town of Salisbury. Where did they first live when they came to Salisbury, Pete? Was your grandfather not Nathaniel Church Scoville?
Yes, that's right.
Nathaniel Church Scoville.
Yeah.
Did they not live in the old Fisher house?
No, I don't know.
On Route 41?
It's quite possible. I really don't know.
On Route 41?
They built a big house down here at the bottom of the hill in Taconic, on Beaver Dam, well, on Taconic, it's now called Taconic Road.
Yes.
And that burned down in 1911, I think it was. And that's where I really started knowing anything about the history. Obviously, I wasn't born in 1911.
No.
Born in 1915. But that house had been the family house. It was one of these great big houses, which was a family house. And I just don't know how long they lived there, but I know they lived there at least 10 or 15 years, and I think it was probably a lot longer than that. So it starts really at the turn of the century, and that house was being lived in, and then it went down. My uncle was alone in the house when it went down. I do remember that story, Uncle Robert, and the rest of the family was in New York. They were living in New York, in house in New York.
Pete, you have a large family of aunts and you have the one uncle.
That's right. There were five. Let's see. Dad had one brother and he had four sisters. Molly McChesney, who you probably know. Lois Warner. And then there was Aunt Grace, who was the oldest. And Edie.
And Edie, whom everyone knew.
Who everybody knew. And the other two, Aunt Grace and Edie, never married. And they used to live here and commute back and forth to New York. Live here in the summer and commute back and forth to New York. And after the big house at the bottom of the hill burned down, which, as I say, was in 1911, I think it was around that time that they had Edie bought the place down at the entrance of this road. It was called Southaway Cottage.
Yes, indeed.
and not too far from where you were living.
Right.
My grandmother was still alive at that point, and she lived there with Aunt Edie and Aunt Grace, and actually her sister lived there for some time with her as well. This is my grandmother's name was Watson, her sister.
Wasson, was that W-A-S-S-O-N?
W-A-S-S-O-N.
Yes.
And grandmother's sister was named Mary. Mary Wasson is Aunt Mary. But she was quite old when I first began to remember things. I remember we used to stop by on Sunday afternoons, see the two of them.
Now, the house down at the foot of the hill, it was the earliest house built in the village here in Taconic, and that burned. Now, then your father and mother built a house on the site of this present house.
That's right, and that was also built in 1911.
Oh, also built in 1911?
Yeah.
Oh.
It was finished in 1911, I guess. And that's where but it was also a very large house, but it wasn't a particularly attractive house. It was sort of red brick and tall and had battlements on it and that kind of thing. And they never really were very fond of that house.
Really?
But they lived in it when they were not in New York, because they lived in New York, basically.
37 East 68th Street.
That's right.
Now this house that your father and mother built also burned.
That's right. That burned down in 1924. And I remember that very well, because we were just about to go to Europe to spend the winter in Europe. I was going to go to school there. So this house was empty, except for Harry Smith and his wife, who were the caretakers. And they were in the back end of the house. And my sister and I, Ovia, were staying down the road at what was then the Pierce's house, which is now Mr. Wittridge's house. And we were staying, since the house wasn't open, my sister and I were staying down at the Wittridge's house, it was then the Pierce's house, for two or three days before we went to Europe. Mother and Dad were in New York.
So you were really young at that point.
Yeah, I was 10 years old.
Yes. And Elvia was 3 years older. Well, that brings us up to...
But one amusing thing about... Not amusing, really, but we were staying in that the night this house that was up here burned down. And we were woken up in the middle of the night by fire engines going by the front door. And so we all said, let's go see the fire. And we got dressed and got in the car and drove up this way, and suddenly we found out it was our own house.
As I recall, Harry Smith and his wife were fortunate to awaken and get out.
Yes, that's right. Part of the house where they were living never actually burned down, but the smoke level must have been very high, because the imprint of their faces on the pillow was very clear while they were still asleep before they got woken up.
Oh, yes.
And the fire was discovered by somebody going down the road. He came up and yelled, apparently, and tried to get somebody up, but they didn't hear him. So he went down to the gatehouse where Mr. Angus was living. And they got him up, and he knew who the Smiths were in the house. So he also knew where their room was. So after having called the fire engines, they came back up here and got them out of bed. But they were mighty lucky.
That was a close one, yes. Yeah.
But, then after that, my mother and father rebuilt a house on this, the present house. It was built here in 1925-26. And we were around, we lived in a little portable house while this was being built.
Down by the tennis court.
Yes, that's right. You know all of this much
better
than that.
Well, I do have a lot of recollections, Pete. Now, your mother, was Arlena
Zabriskie.
Zabriskie.
And she lived, was born and brought up in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
And went to Packer School and then Smith College. And she married, they were married in 1911, I guess.
1911.
And my mother graduated in 1908 from Smith. And maybe it was 1910.
Yes, yes. And a lovely dark-haired lady, as you...
She was a modest person.
Well, we call
tremendous interest. And, but she liked to travel a lot, so did my father liked to travel a lot. In 1934, my mother was over there in Europe, in Portugal, and she visiting some English friends, and she liked the place so much that she got my father to come over, and they looked around for a place to buy in Portugal, and they did eventually, not right away, but eventually bought a place in Portugal called Bacalhoa, which was an old palace that was in ruins, a sort of farm in Palestine in ruins. And just after they bought it, my father was over there, and he died in Portugal. And before they actually really moved into this new house.
Oh, well, I know, Pete. I said goodbye to him at the train when they left for Portugal. Never saw him again.
And so my mother made that rebuilding the Portuguese place sort of a life's work, you know what I mean? Didn't spend as much time here in Salisbury as she perhaps would like to. She always liked Salisbury. She didn't care much for New York.
So, Pete, you had one sister.
Yes. She was 3 years older than me.
3 years older. Her name was Alvia.
And she married a Maurice Verusky, who ran the Housatonic Bookshop in Salisbury. And they had one daughter who was named Marlena after her grandmother, and what is better known as Ollie. And then, sort of coming full circle, when my Aunt Edie died, Ollie, or my niece, and mother's granddaughter, bought that house from the estate, is now living there, and has lived there about 10 years or so.
Yes.
So that same old house has come back.
That is very interesting, isn't it? Yes. Now, Pete, I'd like to have you touch upon your what little of your life you had here in Taconicon, but mainly on your education.
Well, we always used to come up here to Taconicon for summer and usually vacations as well, even before the house burned down. And then afterwards, when this house was built, we spent, gave up on New York. We finally sold the house in New York, and they made this their headquarters. And I remember this house when it was being built, as you mentioned, we were living in a portable house down by where the tennis court was. And while they were building the house, I used to come up and help work on the place. I think when I say help, I was more of a nuisance than and I was helped, but I pretended I was helping anyway. But so I was in on the construction.
You saw it go up anyway.
Yes, that's
amazing.
Right.
Yes.
And then as far as that house was finished, I went to school in New York. In fact, that was probably the main reason why family kept on something in New York, was to provide a basis for going to school. Went to the Buckley School in New York until I was 13, and went to my 14th year before I went away to Andover, was spent just doing tutoring here in the house. And we spent the whole winter up here. That was the winter that the house had just been finished. I went off to Andover and went there for 4 years to school. The reason I didn't go to Hotchkiss was that I knew everybody at Hotchkiss and it wouldn't have been like going away. It really was. And we just quite wisely decided when we should go farther afield. Yeah. So after going to Andover for 4 years, I then went, got very much interested in science at Andover. And went to Yale in 1933. And 4 years there getting a degree, in, bachelor's degree, majoring in chemistry. At that point, the last 2 years while I was still in college, I met Ann Curtis, who lived in Norfolk, and she was only 17 in 1937.
She was 17. I was a little bit young to marry her.
Well, I know I married her when she was 17.
Oh, you did marry her.
I met her when she was 15.
Oh,
and,
well.
And we got married just after I graduated from Yale in 1937. And then I went to Cambridge, England. We both went to Cambridge, England for 2 years, supposedly to get a PhD in chemistry. But the war broke out in the middle of that. And we couldn't get back to Cambridge. We would like to have gone to Cambridge and participate in some way in the war activities. But anyway, we came back here, and winter of 1940, while Tony, our oldest boy, was born. And then I went to University of Rochester to try and finish off my degree in chemistry with them. As the professor at the University of Rochester had been doing work with the person I was working with in Cambridge. So that was the reason for going to Rochester. And we had a lovely time in Cambridge, I must say. But I was always glad to get back home here, and we essentially lived here.
So you received your doctorate here in...
I received my doctorate actually here.
Rochester.
At the University of Rochester, yes. Not until 1942, which is somewhat later than that. And also simultaneously went to work for the, it was a government contract with the University of Rochester, working on improving gas masks for against chemical warfare. And I did that for about 4 years at the University of Rochester on this government project, and worked on trying to make our gas mask charcoal more efficient than it was when the war started. And we did some things, but I also got my degree as credit for that work, so that was worked out very well for everybody. Then, after that, I don't know how much more you want of this.
No, I want all I can get.
After that, I went first out to Utah, where they were testing chemicals, and then I went down to Fort Pierce in Florida, where they had a project in the war trying to develop ways of using smoke to protect amphibious landings and to protect anchorages, because they were taking a terrible beating from the kamikaze pilots and that sort of thing. So I worked for a couple of years at the end of the war on smoke, and incidentally also on the use of DDT to control the insects out in the Pacific. Then after the war, I had not gotten into the atomic energy business at all. But then in 1946, I joined the joint task force, which was set up to go out and test two nuclear explosives at Bikini. And that, that was my initiation into the nuclear weapons business. I was given charge of correlating all the data from all of the monitoring that was done out there on the radioactive fallout and activity in the soil and on the ships and that sort of thing. And I stayed with that particular work, moving over from first to I was paid by the Atomic Energy Commission, and then after, really I was working for the Defense Department, so they finally in 1948 moved me over to Civil Service and Defense Department, and again just studying the effects of nuclear explosions, which I did until 1955. I had one very interesting experience in 1954, in that they had the biggest shot that the United States has ever set off, so-called Bravo explosion, which actually was about 15 megatons. And I was out there at the time. I was not part of the task force, but I was out there as an observer because I had people who were working for me doing experiments there.
Was this in the Pacific?
This was in the Pacific.
Was this the Kwajalein?
Yeah, it was part of the Kwajalein test area. The actual explosions took place in Enewetok and in Bikini itself. And
Pete, we were interrupted for the telephone. You took care of that. Now we're back in business. And we left you in Enewetok and the Kwajalein explosion. Could you tell me, Pete, when you saw this tremendous explosion, would you tell me how you felt?
Well, it gives you a tremendous feeling of awe because it's so large and so it dwarfs anything else you can imagine. It gives you just, no matter how many times, and I've seen many of them, I've seen about 40 or 50 actual explosions. But always, each time you see it, it gives you a new feeling of
gives you
respect for what the dangers that's involved.
Also fear.
Yes, exactly.
Also fear. Does this account for the position you've taken in your writings, your speeches all over the country?
Well, sure. Had some, because it certainly gave me a healthy respect for nuclear explosions. And perhaps the classic example of that was this shot in Enewetok in 1954, when the wind blew in the opposite direction from what had been predicted. And it blew the radioactive fallout back on some islands where there were natives and an Air Force weather unit. And so they had to quickly run in with some ships and take off the natives and this weather unit. But when they took them off, they didn't have any instruments to. They just got them out of there as fast as they could. So there never was no measurement of what the exposures were that they had. So since I didn't have any other job, I was given a destroyer and another. Paul and I went down to these islands after they had all been evacuated. We went ashore and measured the level of activity. And from that level, we could make a rough calculation as to what exposure they had. And it turned out that where the natives were, which was about 110 miles from ground zero, that they probably got exposed to between 100 and 200 Rentgens, which is enough to make happen. Well, it's enough to make you sick, but not quite enough to kill you. So they were very, very lucky.
So you got them out in time.
We got them out in time. When we made the measurements, we also went to some of the other atolls which were not inhabited or lived in. And on that same atoll, just 10 miles farther north, about the same distance from where the bomber were, we calculated they would have gotten 5,000 Rentgens, and everybody would have been killed. So they were extremely lucky. Another 1 degree change in the wind, and they would have all a large fraction of what he would have gotten.
I recall.
But that gave me a healthy respect for the dangers of nuclear war and the dangers of nuclear weapons. So that then in 1955 I went to CIA where I looked at Soviet programs in this area. We better stop. And in the process of keep doing that work, one of the important functions was to backstop arms control negotiations, because unless you know what the nature of the threat is and what the other side has, you don't know what kind of an arms control agreement is in your interest. Furthermore, you have to have good intelligence in order to be able to verify any agreement that's reached. And so I spent, while I was at CIA, I spent a fair amount of time on the whole arms control disarmament problem, trying to improve our government capabilities for monitoring arms control agreements.
Do you think at this time that our intelligence is sufficient to perhaps give us a good picture of what the Soviet Union is doing?
Certainly,
what
in terms
their possibilities
of,
are?
Certainly in terms of planning their major military activities, that we have very good information. We don't necessarily know what they intend to do with it, but we do know what they have and what they don't have. And we have very good data, thanks to satellites, which permit you to take pictures of the entire Soviet Union if you wanted to, within 24 hours.
Which we do, Pete?
Which we do from time to time.
Sure.
In addition to that, you don't always try and do it in one day, because there's no point. You can do it better. Do it real slowly. But then if you see something that's interesting, they have another kind of camera system where they can zoom in and get a close-up picture, so that you can make measurements of whatever it is you're looking at and try and make sure you know what you saw in the general surveillance of the Soviet Union as a whole.
So it's quite generally known that we each have enough of these horrible things to completely destroy the world, probably many times over. Do you think it's possible that these things will ever be used, Pete?
Well, it certainly is possible. I hope that they never will, because if they do, it could well be the end of our civilization. Even if it starts out small and one bomb is used, chances of stopping it at that point are very, very low. Nobody knows how to stop a war like that once it starts. And I think it would be a tendency to, at least you'd have a high probability it would escalate into an all-out nuclear war, which would be essentially mean the end of civilization as we know it today.
Knowing that, and the Russians know that just as well as we do, don't you think the chances of this happening are rather small?
Well, I hope they are. And I agree with you that the Russians know these dangerous effects too. And so in this particular area, although there are lots of things we're in competition with the Soviet Union, in this particular area we have a very strong common interest, and that is to avoid a nuclear war. And what we should be doing is playing on that interest, taking advantage of it, and trying to limit these new weapon systems. But we don't seem to be doing that. What's happening is that usually with the United States in the lead, we go ahead and build new high-technology weapons, which in the long run decrease our security rather than increase our security.
At the same time we're doing this, the Russians are doing it also.
That's right. And it's just each one zigzagging back and forth. And it's a race which brings no one any security and only makes it more likely that we're going to be involved in a nuclear conflict, which would be a disaster.
Is there any way the American people can appeal to not only our leaders, but the leaders of the Soviet Union to...
Well, there are ways of at least trying to influence the Soviet leaders. We do try, and I went there once myself. There are these exchange groups of scientists and others, political scientists, physicists, in which one tries to get across to the other side, what the dangers are, and secondly, what steps are making it more likely that nuclear war will occur so that one can work together to avoid it. These are informal kinds of contacts, quite apart from any of the negotiating tasks.
But there's no way that we can assure the Russians that we are not going to explode this first device.
No, there's no way we can assure them, and unfortunately with the present administration, they don't seem to want to reassure them. They seem to feel that threatening them is the way to get the Russians to back down. I personally don't believe that.
But have not all of our presidents say we will not be the first to
No, they have not. It is a U.S. policy to keep the option open to use nuclear weapons first.
It has been
ever since the thing came up.
I don't think that's generally understood, Pete.
I know it isn't. People forget that we have insisted on keeping the option open to use nuclear weapons first. The argument for this is that we need it because they have a superiority in conventional weapons. But resting our future on the use of nuclear weapons is, to me, just absolutely blind. It's a clear-cut way in which we can all get ourselves destroyed.
Thank you, Pete.
That's a long tape.
Well, we just about finished the tape, but I want to turn it over and get just a few more of your remarks on the other side, if you will.
Okay.